It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today it's heartbreak, glory, and big money. It's the sport of foodies. It's the cook-off. You think the Super Bowl is competitive? Wait till you hear how serious cooks go after the gold. Our guest is Amy Sutherland, author of Cook-Off, Recipe Fever in America. While the Stearns are doing the old-time Southern thing at Mrs. Wilkes' boarding house in Savannah, for all you chili heads, food forager Ari Weintraub talks the great pepper duo of Spain, an investigative reporter reveals the South's dirty little culinary secret, then it's where the new global tea action is with T-Man Bill Waddington, and we've the dogs of Sebastiani. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this. Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and brought to you by Super Target. Well, today it's big money, divine inspiration, and heartbreak, or how to turn your casserole into cash. It's the cook-off. Our guest is Amy Sutherland, author of Cook-Off, Recipe Fever in America. Food forager Ari Weinschwag is going to delight the chili heads with his report on Spain's great pepper duo. Tea expert Bill Waddington reveals the new center for cutting-edge teas. It's an entrepreneur's paradise. Then it's a vineyard where liquid refreshment isn't limited to humans. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. The numbers 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael, the Stearns. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine.
Lynn, if you're looking for lunch in Savannah, Georgia, drive along West Jones Street and look for the restaurant called Mrs. Wilkes Dining Room. Now, the trick is there is no sign outside saying Mrs. Wilkes Dining Room.
Oh, really?
However, you will always find it if you're driving along any time after 11:15 or 11:30 in the morning, because there will be a line outside waiting to get in. Mrs. Wilkes is one of the landmark eating establishments, not just of Savannah or of Georgia, but of the whole South. I mean, this is the definitive boarding house restaurant and has been for decades.
You know, boarding house restaurants in the South, unfortunately, are a dying breed. When Michael and I started doing road food, I wouldn't say they were a dime a dozen, but they were plentiful. I mean, places like the Mendenhall Hotel in Mendenhall, Mississippi, and there were just, I can't even think of the names, but probably a dozen really wonderful ones. I think Mrs. Wilkes may be one of the only remaining ones left in the South.
Now, when Jane says boarding house style meals, in fact, it isn't a boarding house anymore. Mrs. Wilkes, who by the way, passed away in the year 2003, Mrs. Wilkes stopped taking in boarders in 1965. So it hasn't been a boarding house for 30-some years. However, the food is served boarding house style, meaning that you sit at a table with your traveling companions and with strangers, and all the food is set before you in the middle of the table, and this is one place where a boarding house reach to grab what you want is perfectly appropriate.
So they just lay out everything. You don't necessarily order a meal.
No, you don't order. You pay a prefix, and all the food is put out on the table, and any time, let's say, the bowl full of fried chicken or creamed corn starts looking a little empty, a server will come out, remove it, and bring out a new, fresh, full one. And basically, you eat until you've had enough.
And we made a little shorthand list of what we ate when we were there last. We had fried chicken, cornbread dressing, sweet potato souffle, black-eyed peas, okra, gumbo, corn muffins, biscuits, vegetable casseroles, should I keep going? Squash au gratin, scalloped eggplant, cheese grits, corn pudding, pineapple flavored yams with marshmallows, cream corn with bacon drippings, green rice with broccoli and celery, brown rice, and Savannah red rice. And this is not to mention the desserts.
And there was a lot that we didn't get to on that table.
What does the place look like?
It's a real kind of boarding house. I mean, it's a brick building. From the outside, it's kind of, I guess it's what you'd call a row house kind of place. Inside, it's kind of a big, I would say almost festive place, if for no reason other than the fact that everyone who gets into Mrs. Wilkes and finds a place at one of the tables is so happy and joyous to be there. I mean, there's a real sense of, it's like a party. Because there is so much to eat, and not just so much, but so much really good stuff to
eat.
What
it always reminds me of is the Thanksgiving in my dreams, like the Thanksgiving if you liked your family and were happy to see them and sat down to eat with them.
It sounds like a perfect place to have Sunday lunch in Savannah. Hey, thanks, guys.
Bye, Lynn.
One more Sunday in Savannah. Hear the whole creation shout and praise the Lord.
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of the now classic Road Food. Now, you can hear them here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're checking out the site, don't miss signing up for a weekly newsletter. It's brought to you by the Farmers of Organic Valley. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. Every single week, we send you a new recipe for a fast supper dish, technique, and shopping tips. And it's free. So sign up, splendidtable.org. Ari Weinschweig sells food. He's one of the forces behind Zingerman's Deli and Mail Order in Ann Arbor. Ari is also one of the food world's outstanding foragers. The word picky barely describes how Ari operates. He's the author of Zingerman's Guide to Good Eating. Hey, Ari, welcome.
Hi, Lynn.
So, Ari, we've got all this stuff coming in from Spain, especially paprika and peppers, things that we haven't seen before. Could you explain to me, what's the deal with Spanish paprika?
Sure, I'd be happy to. I think in this country, certainly when I started cooking in restaurant kitchens years and years ago, I mean, paprika basically was something that you used for garnish. I don't think anybody thought of it as having flavor. It was just something you might sprinkle on your deviled eggs or whatever for color on a scoop of cottage cheese. That kind of paprika, in my experience, is pretty much like maybe you could say sliced American singles would be to a great farmhouse cheddar.
Mm-hmm.
It's of minimal interest. In Spain, paprika is an amazing ingredient that people count on to contribute, you know, some of the most important flavor elements of many traditional dishes. So it's a really big deal, and for good reason. To understand it, I think it's just, you know, quite simply, we think of chilies now. People have become more familiar, you know, through Rick Bayless's work and other chefs. The great range of chilies from Mexico and from, you know, the American Southwest. And, of course, they're all just different peppers, different varietals. If they're dried, they're dried maybe using different techniques. And the same thing is true for Spain. So even though we use the term paprika and sort of apply it universally to a number of different paprikas, there are different peppers that are dried and ground, and they have different flavors and different aromas.
Are there just a couple of different types, essentially?
Well, I'm sure there's dozens of variations, but there's two main types that would be available here for people that I would, you know, happily recommend. Probably the best known in this country now is the pimentón de la Vera, which comes from the western part of Spain, and it's got a denomination of origin, you know, like a wine or uh-huh. fine cheese. Special pepper that grows in that area, and it's dried over a smoldering oak.
So is it smoky tasting?
It's very smoky tasting, and there is a sweet version and a spicy version generally you can find, and they're both fantastic. I love them because they really add enormous depth of flavor to a dish. A little bit to a tomato sauce or to a stew can be fantastic. They're delicious with meats. And then, of course, they are actually very good with deviled eggs, too, so you can go back to those old standbys.
Right. What's the second one?
The other one comes from the east coast of Spain, from Murcia down in the southeast, and that's a sweeter paprika. It's a paprika, the pepper that's used is the ñora, and it's used throughout up and down the east coast there quite a bit in romesco sauce. But it's a pepper that, unlike the spicy one from the west, it's sweet. It's used in all sorts of dishes. One of the things they do there that I came to love, really, they for breakfast is very typical. They toast a baguette, put some good olive oil from the area on it, a little bit of sea salt, and sprinkle a bunch of paprika on there, and it's delicious.
And these are always powdered, right?
Yeah, they're all, it's ground. Of course, the best ones, again, there's huge quality differences, of course. The best ones, the peppers are dried in the sun still, as opposed to machine drying, and that protects the integrity of the fruit. And then stone ground so that you don't get high temperature to damage the oils in the peppers.
All right, what are piquillos? I know they're a pepper. They come from Spain, but that's all I know.
Well, they're one of the best things around. My assistant has taken to calling them Ari's ketchup because I like to put them in so many dishes. They are a special pepper that grows up in the Basque Country in the northern part of Spain. They have a denomination of origin, so the whole production is regulated and protected. I believe there's about 36 to 37, 40 villages in the surrounding countryside that can grow them within that denomination of origin. And it's a very sort of a smallish, triangular pepper. They're picked in the fall, And then the peppers are roasted over beechwood, and they're peeled completely by hand, which means that they don't use water to wash off the char. If you've done, as many people have, I'm sure, you know, roasted peppers at home, mm-hmm. it's a lot faster if you rinse them underwater. But the problem is that you rinse off a lot of the flavor.
Yeah.
And these peppers, so they're, when you buy them, you'll see they're sort of a brilliant red color, little bits of black char still on there. They're a little bit spicy, but not particularly hot at all. Just very, very wonderfully flavorful. And the smokiness, you know, goes nicely with the spiciness, just a little bit of sweetness. And you can do all sorts of things with them. You can stuff them. I like to stuff them with fresh goat cheese and run them under the broiler. And then put, if you take a nice, beautiful platter, put down a real green olive oil, and then arrange the peppers on top of the olive oil. With a little bit of slivered garlic on there, you get a beautiful hors d'oeuvre, and it's not a lot of work.
So they come essentially like almost whole in a jar.
Yep, yep, they're in the jar. If you take them out, it's not hard to do. You can take them out of the jar. The number in the jar will vary, you know, we found, depending on the size of the pepper, but, you know, 15 to 25, let's say. And then you can actually open them up with your fingers. If you're only moderately careful, you'll be fine. And they stuff them actually in Spain quite a bit with seafood dishes, salt cod or even with tuna and that kind of thing. And serve them in a sauce for a main course or an appetizer. They're great on, you know, just toasted bread with a little bit of olive oil and garlic and sea salt, and then a couple of those on there are wonderful. Chop them up and put them in egg dishes, on salads, on pasta. Really, you can't go wrong, I don't think.
It sounds like they're Ari's ketchup.
Hey, well, they're it's one of those rare items that adds enormous flavor for not a lot of work. So,
hey, Ari, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Ari Weintraub is co-owner of Zingerman's Deli and Mail Order in Ann Arbor. He's author of Zingerman's Guide to Good Eating. Now, you can get his recipe for goat cheese stuffed piquillo peppers on the website, splendidtable.org. You know, there are some ingredients that are so distinctive and complex, they're workhorses, like that smoky hot paprika Ari talked about. I mean, you just don't need much else when you're dealing with these ingredients. For instance, if you take some spare ribs and you rub them with that smoky paprika, some orange zest, and some garlic, refrigerate them overnight, and then just slow roast them, you will be in heaven. Parmigiano Reggiano cheese is one of those ingredients. It lifts other flavors. It's like a catalyst. Sprinkle some over just plain hot vegetables or fish, and you're going to see what I mean. Now, believe it or not, lemon is another. Let me tell you a recipe developer's trick. When a recipe just doesn't sing, finish it off with a squeeze of fresh lemon. Try this on everything from takeout roast chicken to stews and soups. The trick is, once the lemon juice is in, don't cook it any further. You want that fresh, bright taste. Well, coming up, the world of divine inspiration, the cook-off, the South's dirty little secret, and open lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target. It's Target, now available in food, where you can find the expected and unexpected aisle after aisle. Online at target.com/supertarget. Okay, guys, fess up. When nobody's looking, you love to sneak a peek at Survivor and The Bachelorette. We Americans love competitions, and foodies are right up there. Cooking contests are legion. Now, a world of people take them seriously. In fact, some cooks practically pay the mortgage with regular winnings. Now, I don't know that any other country takes the cook-off to the extremes that we do. So to answer the question, is this an American phenomenon, we have Amy Sutherland, author of Cook-Off, Heartbreak, Glory, and Big Money on the Competitive Cooking Circuit. Amy, welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So, Amy, why do you think we do this?
I think we do it for a bunch of reasons. One is that just Americans love competition. I mean, you see that in the sports world, and you see it in schools. Just we like to compete in everything. So this is just another outlet for that competitive drive we have. And then it also reflects our kind of goofy American relationship with food, and that is why other cultures like food to be, taste good ultimately. Americans really like food to be fun and entertaining above even good taste, which explains dishes like, Jell-O and other things that persist. And so these cook-offs really sort of, are a reflection of that great love of food as fun, from the creating the new recipes to the actual sort of like theatricalness of the cook-offs themselves.
So what are the extremes of the contests? I mean, we know about things like the Pillsbury Bake Off, but what's right on the other end of the spectrum?
Well, I think what people don't realize is that the bake-off is just this huge, tip of the iceberg for this huge cook-off world. Like the people have heard of chili, but they don't understand that to compete in chili really means that you're sort of a member of the chili tribe, that it's this deep social cook-off scene. And then there are all kinds of like goofy cook-offs, like in Amish country in Ohio, there's a dandelion cook-off.
The flower or the leaf?
I think whatever you want to throw in there, Lynn, it will get you in the cook-off. And then there are more sort of like the National Chicken Cooking Contest, which is just using, your basic chicken. People have never heard of that, and they don't realize that it was a $25,000 grand prize when I wrote the book, but now it's a $100,000 grand prize.
We're talking big money here.
You're talking serious money. I mean, there's a lot of the cook-off world, like chili, that doesn't have a substantial prize to it, if any. It's just bragging rights. And then you go from that extreme to the, $100,000 prizes and to the million of the bake-off.
So who enters?
Just about anybody you can imagine enters these things. I mean, I met a chili champ who had retired from selling pools to basically go on the chili circuit full-time. His secret ingredient was prunes. I met an air traffic controller on the floor of the bake-off in 2000 who looked around the room and said, well, it's not as bad as the blizzard of 92. There's forensic scientists, there's PhD candidates, there's retired generals, and then there's, the full-time homemakers. But, this is why these contests have stayed with us, because what used to be a sort of activity for homemakers is basically now is for anybody. Anybody who likes to cook, who's competitive, enters these.
Where do the inspirations come from? And I have a specific thing. I have a reason for asking this. You talked to me about somebody who had a fever.
Right. Well, this was one of the craziest stories I heard. I mean, I heard a number of stories of people who felt that God had given them their recipe. That's pretty common. But the most unusual story I heard was a really hotshot real estate agent in Miami had stayed home because he had a really bad fever. And he was in bed, and he just reached for anything that was on the nightstand to read, and it turned out to be his wife's cooking contest newsletter. So he read the description of what was going to be a post-selects brunch cook-off in New York. And he read the what the rules were for the contest. And then he fell into this delirious sleep, one of those really strange sleeps you have when you have a high fever. And he dreamt that he was at the brunch cook-off. He dreamt what his recipe could be. And he dreamt that he had won. And when he woke up, he wrote everything down, showed it to his wife. His wife took his temperature again because she was worried about him. And he entered, and he got in to the cook-off. And it was his first ever try at it. When they called him to tell him he was a finalist, he said, when are you going to announce the finalists? They told him, we just did. So,
what about cheating?
Yeah, there is cheating. It's not what people think it is. Like, it's not sabotage. I think that's what most people expect, except maybe in the world of barbecue. I think there's probably some sabotage that goes on. But in these big cook-offs with the big money, the cheating happens in kind of these gray areas. And one is that people turn in recipes that are not original. And people have gotten busted doing that. The National Chicken Cooking Contest had a very famous case of it in 97, where a well-known contester, a regular contestant in these events, took a recipe that she had already won a pork contest with and basically swapped chicken for pork. Well, that's not really playing by the rules. And the other contestants recognized the recipe from the pork cook-off, and they were quick to rat her out. But unfortunately, the contest didn't really pay attention, and she ended up winning the National Chicken Cooking Contest with this unoriginal recipe. And she, not long after that, kind of got drummed out of contesting. She just sort of disappeared.
Well, you see, there is justice in the long run. Hey, thank you,
Amy. Thank God for that.
Thanks
thank
a lot.
God. You're welcome.
Amy Sutherland is author of Cook-Off, Heartbreak, Glory, and Big Money on the Competitive Cooking Circuit. Every part of the country has its hallmark foods. Some are easy to like barbecue or fried clams. Some are a little bit more challenging, like brain sandwiches. And some local specialties just don't get much attention. They simply appear on your plate and you eat them without much thought. That is, unless you are living in the South and you are writer Scott Hewler.
Moved back to Raleigh, North Carolina, after several years of living away. And before we go one step further, I would like to make an announcement to everyone here. Or no, I'd like to make an announcement to everyone in the entire Southeast. I would not like any grits, please. I do not want grits on my breakfast plate so they can rub up all against my bacon, leaving a sticky white residue that I'll have to remove with a napkin. I do not want any on my dinner plate, where all they'll do is ruin the bottom of a perfectly good biscuit. I do not want the shrimp and grits. I do not want the cheese grits. I do not want your grandmother's grits the way only she can make them. I do not want them with butter, or with sugar, or with maple syrup, or with peppercorns, or with barbecue sauce. I do not want them with red-eye gravy. I do not want them with sausage gravy. Do not tell me that because grits are made from corn, I should want to eat them. Glue is made from horses, but I don't want to ride it. I do not want you to sit next to me at a restaurant or across from me at the breakfast table and say, "Oh, you just don't like grits because you've never had them made right. Try these. Try just one bite, and if you don't like them, I won't ever make you eat anymore, but I'm sure you'll like these." I won't. You can run through your entire routine of possible partners on the combination plate, and grits and I will never have a green eggs and ham happy ending. I understand that by owning my dislike of grits, I drastically reduce any chances of ever being accepted as a true Southerner. But to be honest, as a nice Jewish boy from Cleveland, Ohio, I didn't like my chances there very much anyhow. And this isn't about whether the world would be a better place if the South had won the Civil War, or whether Southerners are any better at telling stories than anybody else, or any of the other supposedly widespread Southern touchstones I ran across in the 9 very happy years I spent in the South before my recent hiatus. This is about grits, which I do not like. I have long wondered why Southerners simply will not allow me to not like grits. And now that I'm back in the South and the onslaught has once again begun, I've come up with several theories. It's possible that the constant attempts to get me to eat grits are just a species of that famed, if hard-headed, Southern hospitality. Then again, it might be evidence of the truism about Southern hospitality being thinly veiled passive aggression towards Yankees like myself. But there's a third possibility, and it terrifies Southerners, because it's true. I have finally figured out why Southerners are so anxious for me to eat their grits. Southerners want me to eat their grits so they won't have to. Every bite for me is one less bite of that nasty stuff for them. It's a dirty little secret. And now that I'm a Southerner again, I'm willing to keep mum. But at a price. So here's the deal. I'll keep quiet as long as you stay away from me with those grits. And don't get me started on okra.
Scott Hewler is a writer living in Raleigh, North Carolina, who makes up for not eating grits by eating twice as much barbecue. Bill Waddington has always been a man with a mission. He became fascinated by tea early on and has spent decades tracking teas to their source, learning from masters. Bill created his shop, The Tea Source, in St. Paul, and he's giving us an ongoing tea primer. Hey, Bill, good to have you back.
It's great to be back, Lynn.
So where has the elusive leaf taken you lately?
About 4 weeks ago, I spent 2 weeks in Sri Lanka, or Ceylon, as tea people tend to know it. And I had a chance to visit more than a dozen tea estates and be there as they created some amazing teas.
I always think of, I don't know a lot about it, but I always think of Ceylon being the center for our teabag teas.
Absolutely. And that's where it's traditionally produced British-style, breakfast-style strong black teas. A lot of them end up in teabags.
Uh-huh.
The last 5-10 years or so, Ceylon has done a tremendous job in pushing the envelope, in being creative. They're making oolongs and green teas and white teas, and they're just doing some amazing things.
So why here? Why Ceylon? What's going on in Ceylon that's not going on other places?
The Ceylon tea industry was nationalized decades ago. And about 10 to 15 years ago, it was reprivatized. It went back, most of the tea estates went back to the private holdings. And a lot of Ceylon tea estates are now held by a family, or a family might own one or two or three tea estates.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not controlled by gigantic conglomerates. And a lot of these small companies, these family-held tea estates, have the ability to be more creative, to try things that are different, to push the envelope a little bit.
All right. You always bring me something to taste. This is like a kid saying, did you bring a gift home from the trip? Do you have an example of what you're talking about?
I absolutely do. And this is a tea that I actually brought 10K of it back in my luggage. And I never got stopped anywhere, which kind of surprises me a little bit.
The timer is going off. Bill has this little cup with a lid on it, and it has tea. Holy cow! Oh, this is amazing. In the cup, he has these look like if you can imagine, dried rosemary needles, like a nest. They smell smoky. This is tea, but what is this?
It's a tea, kind of tea traditionally produced in two counties in China for hundreds of years, and as far as I know, nowhere else until the last 5 years. It's called Silver Needles. It's from the Lumbini Estate in southern Ceylon. I visited the estate the day after they finished making it, and I said, sell me some of this right now. And they went, what are you going to do with it? I'll put it in my bag and bring it in my luggage.
So you brought 20 pounds of this bag?
10 pounds of it in my luggage.
Oh, wow.
Beautiful tea.
This is, I have to tell you, Silver Needles describes it. It's like this lovely nest. I decorate with this. All right, but now the liquid is pale, pale straw gold color. And you can see right through it. And you know what this smells like? It smells like Asian incense and smoke.
That's a good description.
It is so aromatic, you want to put it behind your ears. Okay, can I taste it?
Absolutely, please do.
Oh, my. That feels like it could cleanse your soul. It is so delicate. It's a very light flavor. This is a really sensual tea. So now, when we go into a tea shop, what should we ask for to get our hands on some of these amazing teas from Ceylon?
I'd ask your tea merchant for a Ceylon tea, but then say, but I don't want a black tea. I want something unusual from Ceylon, a green, an oolong, a white, a puchong, any of the other major tea categories that you don't think of as being Ceylon teas, ask for those.
And if you can get your hands on Silver Needles.
Oh, it's a beautiful tea.
Oh, this is magnificent. Bill, thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
Tea merchant Bill Waddington has the Tea Source in St. Paul. Now you can get his tea picks on the website, splendidtable.org.
See you around no more. Where you been? You shall call me. When? Well, I get all my messages. I never got any from you.
The lines are officially open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get to those phones. We have Gina on the line. Gina, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
The art of simmering. When you are making soups, spaghetti, stews, I never know whether to have the lid on or off or partial or, you know, what to do.
That's a good question.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of, I mean, some writers will tell you partially cover, cover, uncover, et cetera, but some will not.
Mm-hmm.
So you're saying when something says simmer for X amount of time, how do you know whether to cover it or not?
Right.
Is that your question?
Uh-huh.
I would say this is the way it works. I'm thinking, huh, this is the way it should work. If you have something that needs long cooking, and it needs to be more or less submerged in whatever kind of liquid you've got it in, right? I would put the cover on and keep it on until whatever you're cooking. I'm thinking like maybe it's a stew, okay? And it's chunks of meat that are not terribly tender, and you want to cook them in that liquid because that helps break down all the connective tissue. So once that meat is tender, then you could uncover it. Because you would uncover when either you can finish the cooking of something or it doesn't need long cooking. And also to concentrate its flavors, because the more you simmer down any kind of cooking liquid, the more intense the flavor becomes.
Right. That's, you know, my thought, too.
Yeah.
So it's mostly what if you are dealing with meat that you're trying to keep submerged.
Well, yeah, but I'm also thinking, I'll give you an instance. I do a green bean sauté. And I do multiple versions of this. It's essentially a braised vegetable dish. So I throw the green beans, which are hard, into the skillet along with onion. I've coated a big skillet with a bit of olive oil, and I try to get some browning going. I throw in garlic, I throw in tomatoes, I throw in all kinds of spices, and maybe some broth, or just let the tomatoes throw off liquid. But I will cover that, because the green beans need some time to cook. If I just leave it uncovered, I'm going to be there for 45 minutes before those puppies cook, and I'll have to keep adding liquid because they don't do very well dry cooking. They do much better being in moisture.
Yeah, and so the steam is collecting.
Exactly. So I'll put a lid on this thing, and then when the beans are ready, they're just near where I want them, I'll uncover it because they're kind of swimming in liquid. And I'll let it simmer and simmer and simmer, stirring it, obviously, to check for sticking, until the liquid has thickened, until it almost forms a glaze around the beans. Because then the beans are tender, but the liquid has now become so rich and so intense, it's an honest-to-God sauce.
Yes.
Does that explain it? Okay.
Well, thanks so much.
That's a great question. That's basic technique questions. Good.
Okay.
Hey, thanks a lot, Gina.
Okay,
goodbye.
Thank you. Bye.
Well, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. Here's the question. Robert Lingen, a health food executive, was sentenced to 15 months in prison for what food-related crime? We're going to have that answer in a moment, and we will be taking more of your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target, one-stop shopping for groceries, cookware, and entertaining. You can find them online at target.com/supertarget. Now, we're going to be taking more of your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, Robert Lingen, a health food executive, was sentenced to 15 months in prison for what food-related crime? He was sentenced for donut fraud. The Wall Street Journal reported that Lingen's health food company marketed a donut he claimed had only 3 grams of fat and 135 calories. Ah, but crime did not pay. Analysis showed Mr. Lingen's donut contained a lush 18 grams of fat and a whopping 530 calories. With his company, Nutrisource, Inc., Mr. Lingen had bought donuts from a commercial baker, repackaged them at 3 times the original price, and sold them as low fat. The FDA was alerted when customers complained about how good all his sweets tasted. Well, while Mr. Lingen serves his time, the corporate scramble continues to create the low-fat donut. There are fortunes to be made here. Of course, the big problem is something Mr. Lingen knows all about. When it comes to donuts, low fat just doesn't taste good. Okay, guys, back to those phones. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Let's see now, who's up next? We've got Darwin on the line. Hey, Darwin, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hello, Lynn. I would like to talk about peanut butter.
Peanut butter?
Peanut butter. I am a giant peanut butter fan, and about 9 months ago I decided to give up all trans fats, and one day I noticed that my favorite brand had trans fats in it. So I went to the all natural type, which is a little bland. So I got to looking around, and I noticed that my favorite brand used a little molasses to give a little extra something to it.
Right.
So I started to do that and add a little salt, you know, when I got the stuff home from the bulk bin at my health food store.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just wondering if there were other ways that I could spice up peanut butter.
What I was thinking as you were talking is sometimes it's really tough being a purist, isn't it?
Yeah. You know?
But there is a brand out there called Real Peanut Butter that's real peanut butter. No trans fats, no fooling around, and it's really great. But with what you've already got, okay, you've put some molasses in it, right?
Right.
Got a bit of salt in there, because usually those are the two prime things that give all the nut butters a kick.
Right.
You know, I'd fool around a little. I'd try a tad more salt. I'd try a little the tiniest hint of red pepper, not so you taste it, but so that it boosts flavors ever so slightly.
Okay.
Because it's this little, I can't explain it, but it's this little, it's like putting a magnifying glass on taste. That little bit of hot pepper. And then, of course, if you really want to fool around, I mean, there is all kinds of stuff you can do to the peanut butter. You can add garlic and Thai fish sauce, and, you know, you can make a fabulous dressing slash dip slash marinade. You know, it's used for satay, the thing they do in Indonesia.
Right.
You know the Mexican sugar? It comes in little cones. It's brown.
Oh, yeah. It's at the local supermarket.
Yeah, because you're in San Antonio. You're in Nirvana, for goodness sakes. That would be fabulous. Oh, and I just thought of something else. Do you have access to mole sauce?
I could probably make some. I don't know of a good sauce for pre-made mole sauce, but I'm not afraid to try and make mine.
But I'm just thinking that even a decent jarred one, because what I'm thinking, not to make it into a Mexican peanut butter, but, you know, the elements in a mole sauce, just like a teaspoon of it to a cup or a cup and a half or 2 cups of peanut butter would probably just make it sing. You already have some salt in, you've already got some sweetness in.
Right.
So there's a couple of ways of approaching it.
That's terrific.
And that Mexican sugar, ooh, that has such good taste.
I'm going to try that.
Okay. Hey, right. let us know how it turns out, Darwin.
Thanks, Lynn.
Hey, you take care.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. You can reach us, 800-537-5252. We've got Eileen calling, and she's calling from Southampton. Hey, Eileen, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. How are you? I love your show.
Hey, thank you.
I'm having so much trouble making enchiladas. I have tried many different techniques for preparing the tortillas,
uh-huh.
Softening them in oil first or in the microwave.
Yeah.
But when I bake them, when I go to serve them, they fall apart, and I wind up with something like enchilada casserole or enchilada parts.
Yeah,
it tastes
yeah.
good, but I don't want the parts. I want the whole enchilada. And I can't get it.
Well, one of the tricks is that you saute those tortillas in a bit of oil. You know, you get the oil pretty hot, and you kind of let them hit the pan, sit there for 30 seconds, flip them over. They almost stiffen because that sort of seals them. But you really want that pan and that oil. You don't need a lot of it. You know, it's just a thin film on the bottom of the pan. But you really that'll stiffen them, and it's not that they're crisp, but it's just that that's sort of like a sealer on them. So that's one thing. If you're maybe not doing,
I'm not doing that.
Yeah. And if you do them in the microwave, by the way, you're creating more trouble than you ever want to get into. You're using corn tortillas, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. But I wonder if the filling or your sauce just might be too wet. And also, I'm wondering, does the enchilada get very greasy?
No, it doesn't.
All right, because sometimes if you bake cheese too long, it throws off all its oils, and it gets very greasy.
No, I don't have that problem. They actually look beautiful. But I'm also wondering about spacing them in the pan.
Oh, yeah. Well, if you crowd the pan...
I'm always thinking they have to abut.
No.
So that they'll stay whole, and then...
Nah. All right, let's try two things, two changes to the recipe. Hot pan... With the film of oil.
Okay.
And stiffen them on both sides. Okay?
Both sides, all right.
Right? And the other thing is, give them about a quarter to a half an inch separation in the pan.
All right.
And don't be too generous with the sauce while they're baking. You can always, you know, add it a little bit later. You don't want them dry, but gosh knows you don't want them sopping.
Oh, I probably do that. I do pour whatever sauce I have left on top of them.
Yeah. And I think the thing is that you're making them just too wet. And you know what? With those changes, you're going to be fine.
That sounds great.
And I can't resist this. You will have the whole enchilada. Okay, enough silliness.
Thank you,
Liz. Hey, but thanks. You know, a lot of people are probably having this problem. You have made people's lives better.
Oh, thank you. Well, my guests will appreciate it very much.
Well, thanks, Eileen.
Take care. Okay, Lynn, you too.
Goodbye. You know, this idea that when you do things like lasagna, enchiladas, etc., if I'm Italian, I always feel more is better, but sometimes it can get a little sloppy, so just hold back a little. Call us, guys, 800-537-5252. We have Katie up next. She's calling from St. Louis, Missouri. Hey, Katie, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I have a question about gyros. If there is a standard recipe or if there's variations, and basically what is gyros and can I make it?
Okay. Well, what gyros or gyros, some people call it, it's G-Y-R-O-S, is it's either ground or slices of meat that are mixed with spices and sometimes breadcrumbs, and it's packed on sort of a spit, but it's vertical. And if you've ever been in a Greek restaurant or a Turkish restaurant, and really a lot of Middle Eastern restaurants, because it's popular in many different countries, it takes slightly different forms. But it's this vertical rotating spit with meat on it. And as you know, the meat looks like an upside down teardrop.
Right.
And you slice meat, very thin slices of that meat, off the outside to make sandwiches, etc. And as far as making your own,
I don't have a spit in my house.
Yeah, and you need a vertical spit with heat that comes from the side. But the biggest difficulty in this is that it, because a long, long time ago, I thought it would be great to make it myself. And that's when I was told, and I then read all the authorities, in the Middle Eastern cookbooks, and they all agreed. So I figured it had to be true that this is never made at home. It's a commercial thing. It's street food.
Okay.
But there is one man who explained how it's done. His name is Clifford Wright, and he did a book about the Mediterranean. I can't remember the name of it, but Mediterranean is in the title, and it's Wright beginning with W.
Okay.
And essentially what he did was a tight-packed meatloaf.
Okay.
But I think, it's a lot of work, and you're going to have to do a lot of fiddling.
Right.
But if you want to take a shot at it, I mean, you could adapt this idea, take really nice lamb, right? Grind
right.
it up and mix it with the spices that are used because it's garlic and allspice. Right, allspice. There's usually some toasted breadcrumbs in there. There's coriander. That's usually, I mean, every country does it a little bit differently, but there's parsley. And then what I would do is make a meatloaf out of that.
Okay.
But do it in a shallow pan so it gets real crusty on the outside.
Okay.
And then you can just shave off and put it into sandwiches. It'll be fabulous. It won't be exactly the same thing, but
it would taste.
It would have. It would taste. And there's always, there's that dynamite yogurt sauce that
right,
always goes.
Tzatziki.
That's it. How do you pronounce it again?
It's pronounced, I believe, tzatziki.
Yes, I think you're right. Yes, yes.
C's and T's and...
It's a lot of T's and C's, and you have to remember to say them all, but in a very interesting way.
And it's like yogurt and garlic and cucumbers and...
Yeah, and it's fabulous.
That. Right. Well, thanks so much. I love your show.
Hey, thank you. And thanks for calling.
Thanks, Lynn.
Take care.
Bye.
Goodbye. Well, you can reach us, 800-537-5252. We've got Ellen calling from Fort Bragg, North Carolina. Hey, Ellen, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi. I remember a cold blueberry soup, which I had one evening that I've never been able to reproduce. It was so delicious. And if I remember it correctly, it had like cream, maybe a little black pepper,
uh-huh.
a hint of lemon, and some blueberries, but I don't have a clue, really.
Okay. Was it creamy?
Little bit.
All right. Let me think for a minute.
This
so you want to know
20 years ago.
Oh. You have been carrying around this dream
uh-huh.
for 20 years. This is this is what I call persistence.
Yes. I don't give up, right?
But you know, one of the things about fruit soups is that I've found is most fruits, if you want to taste pure good fruit, they don't like being heated.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so this is what I think I would do. I would, because you want to thicken it a little bit, I'd take really great blueberries, which means, you know, wait for the season.
Uh-huh.
And what I would do is I would take a big handful of them and I'd puree that, okay, and put it aside. And maybe two big handfuls. I would take something like lightly sweetened water, at maybe a cup of it. And for thickener, okay, I'd bring that to a boil and I would add to it perhaps at most a tablespoon of cornstarch that I've stirred with 2 tablespoons of water. So it's completely smooth and you drop it in the larger quantity of boiling water, stir, stir, stir. It's going to thicken up very quickly. That becomes the thickener for your soup.
That makes sense.
Right? And then what you do is you take those pureed berries and you mix them with half and half. All right. You add grated lemon rind to that. All right. You add some black pepper. You add some sugar to taste. And then you stir whole berries into that. And I think, and I mean, you can strain that puree of fruit if you want, but I love the chunkiness of fruit.
Yeah, I do too.
And you could substitute ripe peaches. You could do strawberries. You know, you could do anything that way. But try that and then dilute with the half and half, or if you wish, cream, to get the consistency you like.
Okay.
But it's blueberry on blueberry.
Ooh. I think you've done it.
Well, I think for a woman who's waited 20 years, you deserve this.
Thank you so much.
You take care, Ellen.
Okay.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Well, you know, when we think about vineyards, we usually conjure up wine. But there is a whole other side to some vineyards. Joining us is Marianne Sebastiani Cuneo from Sebastiani Vineyards in California. Marianne, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Lynn. Now, pleasure to be on it.
Well, Marianne, when we come to Sebastiani Vineyard and we take the tour, we go into
yes.
the tasting room, we taste the wine, but I understand that there's something that's a little extra that's thrown in. What is it?
Well, your first clue might be when you go into our new Sonoma room and you turn around to look at our Sonoma mural, you'll see a beautiful painting of Sonoma Valley. And if you look right in the foreground, you'll notice 3 large dogs overlooking the valley, 2 of which are mine and 1 which is our chief operating officer's dog.
So
and this represents our feeling about our pets and our animals here at Sebastiani. We do have a pet policy, and people are allowed to bring their pets to work. We do mostly keep our dogs in our offices, and people are allowed to take them out on their breaks and to have lunch.
I love
quite
it.
Fun. You go from office to office, very tranquil. You can sit and pet a dog and lower your blood pressure. Amazing.
Sounds good to me. Tell me about your dog. I understand you have a dog that dresses well.
Oh, yeah. She's quite the dresser. Ruby's a Boston Terrier, and she tends to get a little chilly, so we dress her. She has little coats, some with fur, some without. She does like jewelry. Most of it is artificial, but she does have a few nice little pieces that have her name on them. And no earrings, just collars, a complete ensemble. And, you know, she does wear her seasonal shirts for the 49ers and the Giants when they're playing. She also has her play clothes, sweatshirts, hooded sweatshirts. But when she's attending meetings, if she's going to a board of directors meeting or something like that, she comes with her little black fur with her leopard collar. So,
What taste this animal has.
But oh, now, she does.
How many dogs total?
Well, visit regularly we have about 8. We have Fritz and Oscar, Emmy Lou's in marketing, Q, who's the chief operating officer's dog. We have Walter. Walter is in operations. We have Sadie. Sadie is in hospitality. Yes, we have quite a crew here. And if we're if you're working at Sebastiani and you're having a bad day, all you have to do is look at your adoring dog's face, and it's going to be a better day.
Marianne, thank you. What a lovely thought to leave you with. Thanks a lot.
I'm petting mine right now. Take care. Thank you, Lynn.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Marianne Sebastiani Cuneo is president and CEO of Sebastiani Vineyards. They're celebrating their 100th birthday this year. Well, that's the show for this week, everybody. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. Number's 800-537-5252. Until next week, let me leave you with this thought from Samuel Butler. He said, "The greatest pleasure of a dog is that you may make a fool of yourself with him, and not only will he not scold you, but he will make a fool of himself too." The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. Everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And be sure to take a look at our weekly newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. It's made possible by Organic Valley, an independent cooperative of family farmers bringing fresh milk, juice, butter, eggs, and cream to your local supermarket every day. More information is available online at organicvalley.com. Now you can register for that newsletter right on the website. It's easy, it's fun, and best of all, it's free. Our producer is Sally Swift with help from Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Sarah Lear and Judy Graham. Our theme music is by Billy Barber. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Have a great week. Join us next time, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
PRI, Public Radio International.